calmly, but not pathetically, to keep up with a tall, stooped, increasingly bats man's slow, patient, 2-meter stride through airports, train stations, carrying the lenses, inclined ever forward, but in no way resembling any kind of leashed pet. When required to stand upright and still, like when videotaping an ETA service motion or manning the light meters on the set of a high-contrast chiaroscuro art film, Mario in his forward list is supported by a new New York City apartment door-style police lock, a 0.7-meter steel pole that extends from a special Velcroed vest and angles about 40 degrees down and out to a slotted piece of lead blocking. A bitch to carry in that complicated pack, placed by someone understanding and prehensile on the ground before him. He stood thus buttressed on sets himself, let him help erect and furnish in light, the lighting usually unbelievably complex, and for some parts of the crew sometimes almost blinding, sunbursts of angled mirrors, and merino lamps, and key-like Kleegs, Mario getting a thorough technical grounding in a cinematic craft he never even imagined being able to pursue on his own until Christmas of the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, when a gaily wrapped package forwarded from the offices of Incandenza's attorney revealed that himself had designed and built and legally willed in a codicil to be gaily wrapped and forwarded for Mario's 13th Christmas a trusty old Bolex H64 Rex 5 tri-lensed camera.
116.
Bolted to an oversized old leather aviator's helmet and supported by struts whose ends were the inverted tops of training room crutches and curved nicely over Mario's shoulders. So the Bolex H64 required no digital prehensility because it fit over Mario's oversized face like a tri-plated scuba mask and was controlled by a sewing machine-adapted foot treadle.
117.
But even then, it took some serious getting used to. And Mario's earliest pieces of digital juvenilia are marred slash enhanced by this palsied, pointing every which way quality of like home movies shot at a dead run. 5 years hence, Mario's facility with the head mount Bolex attenuates the sadness of his status here, allowing him to contribute via making the annual ETA fundraising documentary cartridge, videotaping students' strokes, and occasionally from over the railing of Stitt's supervisory transom, the occasional challenge match. The tapings become part of the pro-instruction package detailed in the ETA catalog, plus producing more ambitious, arty-type things that occasionally find a bit of an Auclef-type following in the ETA community. After Oren Incandenza left the nest to first hit and then kick collegiate balls, there was almost nobody at ETA, or its Enfield Brighton environs, who did not treat Mario M. Incandenza with the casual gentility of somebody who doesn't pity you or admire you so much as just vaguely prefer it when you're around. And Mario, despite rectilinear feet and cumbersome police lock, the most prestigious walker and recorder in 3 districts, hit the unsheltered area streets daily at a very slow pace, a halting constitutional, sometimes with head-mounted Bolex and sometimes not, and took citizens' kindness and cruelty the same way, with a kind of extra-inclined half-bow that mocked his own canted posture without pity or cringe. Mario's an especial favorite among the low-rent shopkeepers up and down ETA's stretch of Commonwealth Avenue, and photographic stills from some of his better efforts adorn the walls behind certain Commonwealth Avenue deli counters, and steam presses and Korean-keyed cash registers. The object of a strange and maybe kind of clicky affection from Lyle, the spandexed sweat guru, to whom he sometimes brings caffeine-free Diet Cokes to cut the diet's salt, Mario sometimes finds younger ETAs referred to him by Lyle on really ticklish matters of injury and incapacity and character and rallying what remains, and never much knows what to say. Trainer Barry Loach all but kisses the kid's ring, since it's Mario who, through coincidence, saved him from the rank panhandling underbelly of Boston Commons Netherworld, and more or less got him his job.
118.
Plus, of course, there's the fact that Stitt himself constitutionalizes with him of certain warm evenings and lets him ride in his surplus sidecar. An object of some weird, attracto-repulsive gestalt for Charles Tavis, Mario treats C.T. with the quiet deference he can feel his possible half-uncle wanting, and stays out of his way as much as possible for Tavis's sake. Players at Denny's, when they all get to go to Denny's, almost vie to see who gets to cut up the cuttable parts of Mario's under-12-size kilo breakfast. And his younger and way more externally impressive brother Hal almost idealizes Mario, secretly. God-type issues aside, Mario is a semi-walking miracle, Hal believes. People who are somehow burned at birth, withered or ablated way past anything like what might be fair, they either curl up in their fire, or else they rise. Withered Saurian homodonic Mario floats for Hal.
119.
He calls him boo-boo, but fears his opinion more than probably anybody, except their moms's. Hal remembers the unending hours of blocks and balls on the hardwood floors of early childhood's 36 Bell Avenue, west in Massachusetts. Tangrams and See and Spell, huge-headed Mario hanging in there for games he could not play, for make-believe, in which he had no interest other than proximity to his brother. Avril remembers Mario still wanting Hal to help him with bathing and dressing at 13, an age when most unchallenged kids are ashamed of the very space their sound pink bodies take up, and wanting the help for Hal's sake, not his own. Despite himself, and showing a striking lack of insight into his mom's psyche, Hal fears that Avril sees Mario as the family's real prodigy, an inbent, savant-type genius of no classifiable type, a very rare and shining thing, even if his intuition, slow and silent, scares her. His academic poverty breaks her heart. The smile he puts on each AM without fail since the suicide of their father makes her wish she could cry. This is why she tries so terribly hard to leave Mario alone, not to hover or ring, to treat him so less specially than she wants. It is for him. It is kind of noble, pitiable. Her love for the son who was born a surprise transcends all other experiences and informs her life. Hal suspects. It was Mario, not Avril, who obtained Hal his first copies of the unabridged OED at a time when Hal was still being shunted around for the assessment of possible damage, boo-boo pulling them home in a wagon by his bicuspids over the fake rural blacktop roads of upscale Weston, months before Hal tested out at whatever's beyond eidetic on the mnemonic verbal inventory designed by a dear and trusted colleague of the mom's at Brandeis. It was Avril, not Hal, who insisted that Mario live not in the headmaster's house with her and Charles Tavis, but with Hal in an ETA subdorm. But in the year of dairy products from the American heartland, it was Hal, not she, who, when the veiled legate from the union of the hideously and improbably deformed showed up at the ETA driveway's portcullis to discuss with Mario issues of blind inclusion versus visual estrangement, of the openness of concealment the veil might afford him, it was Hal, even as Mario laughed and half-bowed, it was Hal, brandishing his Dunlop stick, who told the guy to go peddle his linen someplace else. The 30th of April to the 1st of May, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The sky of USA's desert was clotted with blue stars. Now it was deep at night. Only above the USA city was the sky blank of stars. Its color was pearly and blank. Marat shrugged.
Perhaps in you is the sense that citizens of Canada are not involved in the real root of the threat?
Steeply shook the head in seeming annoyance.
What's that supposed to mean? He said.
The lurid wig of him slipped when he moved the head with any abrupt force. The first way Marat betrayed anything of emotion was to smooth rather too fussily at the blanket on his lap.
It is meaning that it will not a finality be Quebecers making this kick to l'un des États-Unis. Look, the facts of the situation speak loudly. What is known? This is a USA production, this entertainment cartridge, made by an American man in the USA. The appetite for the appeal of it, this also is USA. The USA drive for spectation, which your culture teaches. This, I was saying, this is why choosing is everything. When I say to you choose with great care in loving, and you make ridicule, it is why I look and say, can I believe this man is saying this thing of ridicule? Marat leaned slightly forward on his stumps, leaving the machine pistol to use both his hands and saying. Steeply could tell this was important to Marat. He really believed it. Marat made small, emphatic circles and cuts in the air while he spoke. This facts of situation, which speaks so loudly of your bureau's fear of this Samizdat, now is what has happened when a people choose nothing over themselves to love, each one. A USA that would die, and let its children die, each one, for this so-called perfect entertainment, this film. Who would die for this chance to be fed this death of pleasure with spoons, in their warm homes, alone, unmoving? Hugh Steeply, in complete seriousness, as a citizen of your neighbor, I say to you, forget for a moment the entertainment, and think instead about the USA, where such a thing could be possible enough for your office to fear. Can such a USA hope to survive for a much longer time? To survive as a nation of peoples? To much less exercise dominion over other nations of other peoples? If these are other peoples who still know what it is to choose, who will die for something larger, who will sacrifice their warm home, the loved women at home, their legs, their life even, for something more than their own wishes of sentiment? Who will choose not to die for pleasure alone? Steeply removed with cool deliberation another Belgian cigarette and lit it, this time on the first match, waving the match out with a circular flourish and snap. All this took time of his silence. Marat settled back. Marat wondered why the presence of Americans could always make him feel vaguely ashamed after saying things he believed, an aftertaste of shame after revealing passion of any belief and type when with Americans, as if he had made flatulence instead of had revealed belief. Steeply rested his one elbow on the forearm of the other arm across his prostheses, to smoke like a woman.
You're saying that the administration wouldn't even be concerned about the entertainment if we didn't know we were fatally weak, as in, as a nation. You're saying the fact that we're worried speaks volumes about the nation itself.
Marat shrugged. As we will force nothing on USA persons in their warm homes. We will make only available entertainment. There will be then some choosing to partake or choose not to.
Smoothing slightly at his lapse blanket.
How will USAs choose? Who has taught them to choose with care? How will your offices and agencies protect them, your people? By laws? By killing Quebecois?
Marat rose, but very slightly.
As you are killing Colombians and Bolivians to protect USA citizens who desire their narcotics? How well did this work for your agencies and offices, the killing? How long was it before the Brazilians replaced the dead of Colombia?
Steeply's wig had slipped hard to starboard.
Ramey, no. Drug dealers don't want you dead necessarily. They just want your money. There's a difference. You people seem to want us dead. Not just the concavity re-demised. Not just secession for Quebec. The FLQ? Maybe they're like the Bolivians. But Fortier wants us dead.
Again you pass over what is important. Why BSS cannot understand us. You cannot kill what is already dead.
Just you wait and see if we're dead, Paisano.
Marat made a gesture as if striking his own head.
Again passing over the importance. This appetite to choose death by pleasure, if it is available to choose. This appetite of your people unable to choose appetites, this is the death. What you call the death, the collapsing, this will be the formality only. Do you not see? This was the genius of Guillaume de Plussy. What Monsieur de Plussy taught the cells, even if FLQ and Le Fille did not understand. Much less the Albertans, all crazy inside their head. We of the AFR, we understand. This is why the sale of Quebecers, that danger of entertainment so fine it will kill the viewer. If so, the exact way does not matter. The exact time of death and way of death is no longer matters. Not for your peoples, you wish to protect them. But you can only delay, not save. The entertainment exists. The attaché and the gendarme of the Razzle incident? More proof. It is there, existing. The choice for death of the head by pleasure now exists, and your authorities know. Or you would not be now trying to stop the pleasure. Your Saint-Christy gentle was in this one part correct. Someone is to blame.
That had nothing to do with the reconfiguration. The reconfiguration was self-preservation.
That, forget it. There is the villain he saw you needed, all of you, to delay this splitting apart, to keep you together, the hating some other.
Gentle is crazy in his head, but in this, fault of someone, he was correct in saying it. Un ennemi commun.
But not someone outside you, this enemy. Someone or some people among your own history sometime killed your USA nation already, Hugh. Someone who had authority, or should have had authority, and did not exercise authority. I do not know. But someone, sometime, let you forget how to choose and what. Someone let your peoples forget it was the only thing of importance, choosing. So completely forgetting that when I say choose to you, you make expressions with your face, such as, here we are going. Someone taught that temples are for fanatics only, and took away the temples and promised there was no need for temples. And now, there is no shelter, and no map for finding the shelter of a temple. And you all stumble about in the dark, this confusion of permissions. The without-end pursuit of a happiness of which someone let you forget the old things which made happiness possible. How is it you say? Anything is going?
And this is why we shudder at what a separate Quebec would be like. Choose what we tell you. Neglect your own wish and desires. Sacrifice. For Quebec. For the state.
Marat shrugged. L'état protecteur.
Steeply said, does this sound a little familiar, Remy? The National Socialist, neo-fascist state of separate Quebec? You guys are worse than the worst Albertans. Totalitarity. Cuba with snow. Ski immediately to your nearest re-education camp for instructions on choosing. Moral eugenics. China, Cambodia, Chad, unfree.
Unhappy.
There are no choices without personal freedom, buckaroo. It's not us who are dead inside. These things you find so weak and contemptible in us, these are just the hazards of being free.
But what does this USA expression want to mean, this buckaroo?
Steeply turned to face away into the space they were above.
And now here we go. Now you will say, how free are we if you dangle fatal fruit before us and we cannot help ourselves from temptation? And we say, human to you. We say that one cannot be human without freedom.
Marat's chair squeaked slightly as his weight shifted.
Always with you this freedom. For your walled-up country, always to shout, freedom, freedom! As if it were obvious to all people what it wants to mean, this word. But look, it is not so simple as that. Your freedom is the freedom from. No one tells your precious individual USA settlers what they must do. It is this meaning only, this freedom from constraint and forced duress.
Marat, over Steeply's shoulder, suddenly can realize why the skies above the coruscating city were themselves erased of stars. It was the fumes from the exhausts, wastes of the moving autos, pretty lights that rose and hid stars from the city and made the city Tucson's loom nacreous in the dome's blankness of it.
But what of the freedom to? Not just free from. Not all compulsion comes from without. You pretend you do not see this. What of freedom to? How for the person to freely choose? How to choose any but a child's greedy choices if there is no loving field father to guide, inform, teach the person how to choose? How is there freedom to choose if one does not learn how to choose?
Steeply threw away his cigarette and faced partly Marat from the edge.
Now the story of the rich man.
Marat said, "The rich father who can afford the cost of candy, as well as food for his children. But if he cries out, 'Freedom!' and allows his child to choose only what is sweet, eating only candy, not pea soup and bread and eggs, so his child becomes weak and sick. Is the rich man who cries freedom the good father?"
Steeply made four small noises. Excitement of some belief made the American's electrolysis's little pimples of rash redden even in the milky dilute light of loom and low stars. The moon over the mountains of Rincon was on its side, its color the color of a fat man's face.
Marat could believe he could hear some young USA voices shouting and laughing in a young gathering somewhere out on the desert floor below, but saw no headlights or young persons.
Steeply stamped a high heel in frustration. Steeply said,
"But U.S. citizens are presumed by us to be children, to paternalistically do their thinking and choosing for them. Human beings are not children."
Marat pretended again to sniff.
"Ah, yes, but then you say, no?"
Steeply said, "No. You say, not children? You say, what is the difference, please, if you make a recorded pleasure so entertaining and diverting it is lethal to persons? You find a copy-capable copy, and copy it and disseminate it for us to choose to see or turn off, and if we cannot choose to resist it, the pleasure, and cannot choose instead to live? You say what your Fortier believes, that we are children, not human adults like the noble Quebecers. We are children, bullies, but still children inside, and we kill ourselves for you if you put the candy within the arm's reach."
Marat tried to make his face expressive of anger, which was difficult for him.
"This is what happens. You imagine the things I will say, and then say them for me, and then become angry with them. Without my mouth, it never opens. You speak to yourself, inventing sides. This itself is the habit of children. Lazy, lonely, self. I am not even here, possibly, for listening to."
Unmentioned by either man was how in heaven's name either man expected to get up or down from the mountain-sized shelf in the dark of the U.S. desert's night. The 8th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, Interdependence Day. Every year at ETA, maybe a dozen of the kids between maybe like 12 and 15, children in the very earliest stages of puberty, and really abstract, capable thought, when one's allergy to the confined realities of the present is just starting to emerge as weird kind of nostalgia for stuff you never even knew.
120.
Maybe a dozen of these kids, mostly male, get fanatically devoted to a homemade academy game called Eschaton. Eschaton is the most complicated children's game anybody around ETA'd ever heard of. No one's entirely sure who brought it to Enfield, from where, but you can pretty easily date its conception from the mechanics of the game itself. Its basic structure had already pretty much coalesced when Alston's Michael Pemulis hit age 12 and helped make it way more compelling. Its elegant complexity, combined with a dismissive reenactment frisson, and a complete disassociation from the realities of the present, composes most of its puerile appeal. Plus, it's almost addictively compelling, and shocks the tall. This year it's been Otis P. Lord, a 13-year-old baseliner and calculus phenom from Wilmington, Delaware, who wears the beanie as Eschaton's game master and statistician of record, though Pemulis, since he's still around and is far and away the greatest Eschaton player in ETA history, has a kind of unofficial emeritus power of correction over Lord's calculations and mandate. Eschaton takes 8 to 12 people to play, with 400 tennis balls so dead and bald they can't even be used for service drills anymore, plus an open expanse equal to the area of 4 contiguous tennis courts, plus a head for data retrieval and coldly logical cognition, along with at least 40 megabytes of available RAM and wide array of tennis paraphernalia. The Vedi Mikamish rulebook that Pemulus in YPW got Hal Incandenza to write, with appendices and sample C:/PINK:/MathPack:/NSTAT:/Path:/DecisionTreeDiagrams, and an offset of the most accessible essay Pemulus could find on applied game theory, is about as long and interesting as J. Bunyan's stupefying Pilgrim's Progress from this world to that which is to come, and a pretty tough nut to compress into anything lively. Although every year a dozen more ETA kids memorize the thing at such a fanatical depth that they sometimes report reciting mumbled passages under light dental or cosmetic anesthesia years later. But if Hal had a Luger pointed at him and were under compulsion to try, he'd probably start by explaining that each of the 400 dead tennis balls in the game's global arsenal represents a 5-megaton thermonuclear warhead. Of the total number of a given day's players,
121.
3 compose a theoretical Anschluss designated Amnat. Another 3, Sovwar. 1 or 2, Red Chai. Another 1 or 2, the wacko but always pesky, Libseer. Or more formidable, Ear Libseer. And that the day's remaining players, depending on involved random considerations, can form anything from South Af to Ind Pak to like an independent cell of Nook insurgents with a 50-click howitzer and big ideas. Each team is called a combatant. On the open expanse of contiguous courts, combatants are arrayed in positions corresponding to their location on the planet Earth as represented in the Rand McNally slightly rectangular hanging map of the world.
122.
Practical distribution of total megatonnage requires a working knowledge of the mean value theorem of integrals.
123.
But for Hal's synoptic purposes here, it's enough to say that megatonnage is distributed among combatants according to an integrally regressed ratio of A, combatants' yearly military budget as percentage of combatants' yearly GNP, to B, the inverse of stratego-tactical expenditures as percentage of combatants' yearly military budget. In quainter days, combatants' balls were simply doled out by throws of shiny red Yahtzee dice. Quaint chance is no longer required because Pemulus has downloaded MathPack Unlimited's elegant NSTAT Stats Cruncher software into the late James Incandenza's fearsome, idle, drop-cloth DEC 2100.
124.
And has shown Otis P. Lord how to dicky the lock to Stitt's office at night with a dining hall meal card and plug the DCE into a 3-prong that's under the lower left corner of the enormous print of Dewar's The Magnificent Beast on the wall by the relevant edge of Stitt's big glass desk. So Stitt or DeLint won't even know it's on, when it's on, then link it by cellular modem to a slick you-shit-you portable with collar monitor out on the court's nuclear theater. Amnat and Sovwar usually end up with about 400 total megatons each, with the rest inconsistently divided. It's possible to complicate Pemulus's mean value equation for distribution by factoring in stuff like historical incidences of bellicosity and appeasement, unique characteristics of perceived national interests, etc. But Lord, the son of not one but 2 bankers is a straight bang-for-buck type of apportioner, a stance the equally bottom-line-minded Michael Pemulus endorses with both thumbs. Pieces of tennis gear are carefully placed within each combatant's territories to mirror and map strategic targets. Folded gray on red ETA t-shirts are MAMAs, or Major Metro Areas. Towels are stolen from selected motels on the junior tour stand for airfields, bridges, satellite-linked monitoring facilities, carrier groups, conventional power plants, important rail convergences. Red tennis shorts with gray trim are CON4CONs, meaning conventional force concentrations. The black cotton ETA armbands, for when God forbid there's a death, designate the non-contemporary game era's atomic power plants, uranium or plutonium enrichment facilities, gaseous diffusion plants, breeder reactors, initiator factories, neutron scattering reflector labs, tritium production reactor vessels, heavy water plants, semi-private shaped charge concerns, linear accelerators, and the especially point-heavy annular fusion research laboratories in North Syracuse, New York, and Presque Isle, Maine, Chongqing, Kyrgyzstan, and Pliskiu, Romania, and possibly elsewhere. Red shorts with gray trim, few in number because strongly disliked by the traveling squads, are SSTRACs, equally low number but point-intensive sites of strategic command. SOCs are either missile installations or anti-missile installations or isolated silo clusters or cruise-capable B-2 or SS-5 squadrons. Let's draw the curtain of charity across any more millibrebs. Depending on whether they're boys' tennis socks or boys' street shoe socks or girls' tennis socks with the little bunny tail at the heel or girls' tennis socks without the bunny tail. Toe-worn, cast-off, corporate-supplied sneakers sit open-mouthed and serenely lethal, strongly suggesting the subs they stand for. In the game, combatants' 5-megaton warheads can be launched only with handheld tennis rackets. Hence, the requirement of actual physical targeting skill that separates Eschaton from rotisserie league Holocaust games played with protractors and PCs around kitchen tables. The paraboloid transcontinental flight of a liquid-fuel strategic delivery vehicle closely resembles a top-spin lob. One reason the ETA administration and staff unofficially permit Eschaton to absorb students' attention and commitment might be that the game's devotees tend to develop terrific lobs. Pemulis' lobs can nail a coin on the baseline 2 out of 3 times off either side, is why it's idiotic that he rushes the net so much instead of letting the other guy come in more. Warheads can be launched independently or packed into an intricately knotted athletic supporter designed to open out in mid-flight and release multiple independent reentry vehicles known as MIRVs. MIRVs, being a profligate use of a combatant's available megatonnage, tend to get used only if a game of Eschaton metastasizes from a controlled set of spasm exchanges, known as SPASX, to an all-out apocalyptic series of punishing strikes against civilian populations, known as SACPOP. Few combatants will go to SACPOP unless compelled by the remorseless logic of game theory, since SACPOP exchanges usually end up costing both combatants so many points they're eliminated from further contention. A given Eschaton's winning team is simply that combatant with the most favorable ratio of points for INDEER, or Infliction of Death, Destruction, and Incapacitation of Response, to SUFDEER, Self-Evident, though the assignment of point values for each combatant's shirts, towels, shorts, armbands, socks, and shoes is statistically icky. Plus, there are also wildly involved corrections for initial megatonnage, population density, land-sea-air delivery distributions, and EM pulse-resistant civil defense expenditures, so that the official victor takes 3 hours of NSTAT number crunching and at least 4 Motrin for Otis P. Lord to confirm. Another reason why each year's master statistician has to be a special combination of tech wonk and compulsive is that the Baroque apparatus of each Eschaton has to be worked out in advance and then sold to a kind of immature and easily bored community of world leaders.
A quorum of the day's combatants has to endorse a particular simulated world situation, as Lords stayed up well past several bedtimes to develop it.
Land, sea, air force distributions, ethnic, sociologic, economic, and even religious demographics for each combatant, plus broadly sketched psych profiles of all relevant heads of state, prevailing weather in all the maps, quadrants, etc. Then everybody playing that day is assigned to a combatant's team, and they all sit down over purified water and unfettered chips to hash out between combatants stuff like mutual defense alliances, humane war pacts, facilities for intercombatant communication, DEFCON gradients, city trading, and so on. Since each combatant's team knows only their own situation profile and total available megatonnage, and since even out in the forecourt theater the stockpiled warheads are hidden from view inside the identical white plastic cast-off industrial solvent buckets all academies and serious players use for drill balls,
125.
There can be a lot of poker facing about response resolve, willingness to go sack pop, non-negotiable interests, EM pulse immunity, distribution of strategic forces, and commitment to geopolitical ideals. You should have seen Michael Pemulis just about eat the whole world alive during pre-Eschaton summits back when he played. His teams won most games before the first lob landed. What often takes the longest to get a quorum on is each game's triggering situation. Here, Lord, like many stellar statistics wonks, shows a bit of an Achilles heel imagination-wise. But he's got a good 5 or 6 years of Eschaton precedence to draw on. A Russo-Chinese border dispute goes tactical over Xinjiang. An Amnot computer tracker in the Aleutians misreads a flight of geese as 3 Sovwar SS-10s on re-entry. Israel moves armored divisions north and east through Jordan after an El Al Airbus is bombed in mid-flight by a cell linked to both Husseins. Black Albertan wackos infiltrate an isolated silo at Fort Chimo and get 2 MIRVs through South AF's defense net. North Korea invades South Korea, vice versa. AMNAT is within 72 hours of putting an impregnable string of anti-missile satellites online, and the remorseless logic of game theory compels Sovwar to go sackpop while it still has the chance. On Interdependence Day, Sunday, 11-8, Game Master Lord's triggering situation unwinds nicely, on Pemulis' view. Explosions of suspicious origin occur at AMNAT satellite receiver stations from Turkey to Labrador as 3 high-level Canadian defense ministers vanish. And then a couple of days later are photographed at a Volgograd bistro, hoisting shots of Stolichnaya with Slavic bimbos on their knee.
126.
Then 2 Sovwar trawlers, just inside international waters off Washington, are strafed by F-16s on patrol out of Cape Flattery Naval Base. Both AMNAT and Sovwar go from DEFCON 2 to DEFCON 4. Red Chai goes to DEFCON 3, in response to which Sovwar airfields and anti-missile networks from Irkutsk to the Jugjur Range go to DEFCON 5, in response to which AMNAT sack bombers and anti-missile missile silos in Nebraska and South Dakota and Saskatchewan and eastern Spain assume a maximum readiness posture. Sovwar's bald and port wine-stained premier calls AMNAT's waddle-chinned president on the hotline and asks him if he's got Prince Albert in a can.
127.
Another pretty shady explosion levels a Sovwar Big Ear monitoring station on Sakhalin. General Atomic Inc.'s gaseous diffusion uranium enrichment facility in Portsmouth, Ohio, reports 4 kilograms of enriched uranium hexafluoride missing, and then suffers a cataclysmic fire that forces evacuation of 6 downwind counties. An AMNAT minesweeper of the 6th Fleet on maneuvers in the Red Sea is hit and sunk with Red Chai silkworm torpedoes fired by Libseer MiG-25s. Italy, in an apparently bizarre NSTAT-generated development, Otis P. Lord will only smile enigmatically about, invades Albania. So if war goes apeshit, apoplectic premier rings Amnat's president, only to be asked if his refrigerator's running. Libsir shocks the Christian world by airbursting a half-megaton device 2 clicks over Tel Aviv, causing deaths in the low 6 figures. Everybody and his brother goes to DEFCON 5. Air Force One leaves the ground. South Af and Red Chai announce neutrality and plead for cool heads. Israeli armored columns behind heavy tactical artillery saturation push into Syria all the way to Abu Kanal in 12 hours. Damascus has firestorms. And Nebk is reportedly just plain gone. Several repressive right-wing regimes in the Third World suffer coup d'état and are replaced by repressive left-wing regimes. Tehran and Baghdad announce full diplomatic and military support of Libsir, thus reconstituting Libsir as Ir Libsir. Amnat and Sovwar activate all civil defense personnel and armed forces reserves and commence evacuation of selected MAMAs. Ir Libsir is today represented by Evan Ingersoll, whom Axford keeps growling at under his breath, Hal can hear. A shifty-eyed member of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff vanishes and isn't photographed anywhere. Albania sues for terms. Crude and apparently amateur devices in the low kiloton range explode across Israel from Haifa to Ashkelon. Tripoli is incommunicado after at least 4 thermonuclear explosions cause second-degree burns as far away as Medinine, Tunisia. A 10-kiloton tactical artillery device airbursts over the command center of the Czech Third Army in Ostrava, resulting in what one Pentagon analyst calls a serious weenie roast. Despite the fact that nobody but Sovwar itself has anybody close enough to hit Ostrava from howitzer distance, Sovwar stonewalls Amnat's denials and regrets. Amnat's president tries ringing Sovwar's premier from the air, and gets only the premier's answering machine. Amnat is unable to determine whether the string of explosions at its radar installations all along the Arctic Circle are conventional or tactical. CIA-NSA reports that 64% of the civilian populations of Sovwar's MAMAs have been successfully relocated below ground in hardened shelters. Amnat orders evacuation of all MAMAs. Sovwar MiG-25s engage Red Chai aircraft overseas off Tianjin. Air Force 2 tries to leave the ground and gets a flat tire. A single 1-megaton SS-10 evades anti-missile missiles and detonates just over Provo, Utah, from which all communications abruptly cease. Eschaton's Game Master now posits, but does not go so far as to actually assert, that Enstat's game theoretic decision tree now dictates a SpaceX response from Amnat. Uninitiated adults who might be parked in a nearby mint-green advertorial Ford sedan, or might stroll casually past ETA's 4 easternmost tennis courts and see an atavistic global nuclear conflict game played by tanned and energetic little kids, and so this might naturally expect to see fuzzless green warheads getting whacked indiscriminately skyward all over the place as everybody gets blackly drunk with thanatoptic fury in the crisp November air, these adults would more likely find an actual game of Eschaton strangely subdued, almost narcotized-looking. Your standard round of Eschaton moves at about the pace of chess between adepts. For these devotees become, on court, almost, parodically, adult. Staid, sober, humane, and judicious 12-year-old world leaders trying their best not to let the awesome weight of their responsibilities, responsibilities to nation, globe, rationality, ideology, conscience, and history, to both the living and the unborn, not to let the terrible agony they feel at the arrival of this day, this dark day the leaders have prayed would never come, and have taken every conceivable measure rationally consistent with national strategic interest to avoid, to prevent. Not to let the agonizing weight of responsibility compromise their resolve to do what they must to preserve their people's way of life. So, they play, logically, cautiously, so earnest and deliberate in their calculations, they appear thoroughly and queerly adult, almost Talmudic from a distance.
A couple gulls fly overhead.
A mint-green Ford sedan has passed through the gate's raised portcullis and is trying to parallel park between two dumpsters in the circular drive behind West House, which is behind and to the neck-straining left of the Gatorade Pavilion. There's an autumnal tang in the air and a brittle gray shell of cloud cover, plus the constant faraway hum of Sunstrand Plaza's ATHS-CME fan line. Strategic acumen and feel for realism vary from kid to kid, of course. When Earlib Sears Evan Ingersoll starts lobbing warheads at Sobor's belt of third-wave reserve silos in the Kazakh, and it becomes pretty clear that Amnat has won Earlib Sear to its side by making sinister promises about the ultimate disposition of Israel. Israel, even though nobody's Israel out there today, seems in a fit of pique to have somehow persuaded South Af, who today is Brooklyn, New York's little hard-ass Josh Gopnik, the same Josh Gopnik who, by the way, subscribes to commentary, to expend all 16 of its green fuzzy warheads in a debilitating enfilade against Amnat dams, bridges, and bases from Florida to Baja. Everybody involved orders total displacement of MAMA populations. Then, without any calculation whatever, INDPAC, who today is J.J. Penn, a high-ranked 13-year-old but not actually the brightest log in the Yuletide fire, dumps three poorly tied jockstraps worth of MIRVs on Israel, landing most of the megatonnage in sub-Beersheba desert areas that didn't look much different before the blasts. When roundly kibitzed from the shelter of the Gatorade Pavilion under Stitz Tower by Trolch, Axford, and Incandenza, Penn shrilly reminds them that Pakistan is a Muslim state and sworn foe to all infidelic enemies of Islam, but can do little but fiddle with the strings of his launcher when Pemulis cheerfully reminds him that nobody's Israel today, and there isn't so much as a combatant's sock on that part of the courts. It is not a matter of the principle of thing, ever, in Eschaton. Except for the South Af flurry and in-pack boner, 11-8's game proceeds with much probity and cold deliberation, with even more pauses and hushed, chin-stroking conferences today than tend to be the norm. The only harried-looking person on the 1,300-meter map is Otis P. Lord, who has to keep legging it from one continent to another, pushing a rolling double-shelf stainless steel food cart purloined from St. John of God Hospital with a blinking You Shit You portable on one shelf and a 256-capacity diskette case about two-thirds full on the other, the shelves' sides hung with clattering clipboards, Lord having to dramatize manually the effortless dictates of real logic and necessity, verifying that command decisions are allowable functions of situation and capacity. He'd shrugged his shoulders in a neutral whatever at South Af and INDPAC. Locating necessary data for subterranean premiers and dictators and airsick presidents, removing vaporized articles of clothing from sites of devastating hits and just wopsing them up or folding them over at the sites of near hits and fizzle yields. Triangulating electromagnetic pulse estimates from confirmed hits to authorize or deny communication capacity. It's a nerve-wracking job. He's more or less having to play God, tallying kill ratios and radiation levels and parameters of fallout, strontium-90 and iodine levels, and the likelihood of conflagrations versus firestorms in MAMAs with different mean value skyscraper heights and combustible capital indices. Despite chapped hands and a badly running nose, Lord's response time to requests for data is impressive, thanks mainly to the sly DEC hookup and the detailed decision algorithm files Pemulis had authored 3 years back. Otis P. Lord informs Sovwar and Amnat that Peoria, Illinois' topographic flatness ups the effective kill radius for Sovwar's 5-megaton direct hit to 10.1 clicks, meaning half of this MAMA pop burns to death in evacuatory traffic jams out on Interstate 74. An Amnat Minuteman can hold an absolute maximum of 8 MIRVs, irregardless of whether the Titanic jockstrap Little Lamont Chu promoted out of the sedated Teddy Shock's gear bag on the bus Friday night can hold 13 dead tennis balls. Given standard climatic conditions, the fire area from an airburst will be 2 pi times larger than the blast area. Toronto has enough subcode skyscrapers within its total area to guarantee a firestorm off a minimum of 2 strikes within 2 pi. Times, within parentheses, 1 over the total Toronto area in meters, squared, of target center. 5 megatons of heavy hydrogen fusion yields at least 1,400,000 curies worth of strontium-90, meaning microcephalic kids in Montreal for roughly 22 generations. And yes, Wiseacre McKenna of Amnat, the world will probably notice the difference. Struck and Trevor Axford hoot loudly from under the green Gatorade thirst aid awning of the open-air pavilion outside the fence along the south side of the East Courts, where, the pavilion, they and Michael Pemulis and Jim Trolch and Hallin Condenza are splayed on reticulate mesh patio chairs in street clothes and with their street sneakers up on reticulate mesh footstools. Struck and Axford with suspiciously bracing Gatorades and what looks like a hand-rolled psychochemical cigarette of some sort being passed between them. 11-8 is an ETA day of mandatory total R&R, though the public intoxicants are a bit much. Pemulis has a bag of red-skinned peanuts he hasn't eaten much of. Trevor Axford has over-inhaled from the cigarette and is hunched, coughing, his forehead purple. Hallin Condenza is squeezing a tennis ball and leaning out far to starboard to spit into a NASA glass on the ground, and struggling with a strong desire to get high again for the second time since breakfast, versus a strong distaste about smoking dope with or in front of all these others, especially out in the open, in front of little buddies, which seems to him to violate some sort of issue of taste that he struggles to articulate satisfactorily to himself. A tooth way back on the upper left is twinging electrically in the cold air. Pemulis, though, from his twitchy right eye, he's clearly had recent recourse to some tenuate, which helps explain the uneaten nuts, is currently abstaining and sitting on his hands for warmth. Peanuts on the floor, well away from Hal's NASA glass. The pavilion is open on all sides, and compliments of Stokely Van Camp Corporation, and little more than a big, fancy tent, with a green felt cover over the expanse's real grass and white iron patio furniture with reticulate plastic mesh. It's mostly used for civilians' spectation during exhibition matches on the East Show Courts 7, 8, and 9. Sometimes ETAs cluster under it during drill breaks in the summer in the heat of the day. The green awning gets taken down when they go into the lung for the winter. Eschaton traditionally commandeers courts 6 through 9, the really nice east courts, unless there's legit tennis going on. All the upper-class spectators, except Jim Struck, are former Eschaton devotees, though Hal and Trolch were both marginal. Trolch, who's also pretty clearly had some tenuit, is left-eye nystagmus and is calling the action into a disconnected broadcast headset. But Eschaton's tough to enliven, verbally, even for the stimulated, being generally too slow and cerebral. Struck is telling Axford to put his hands over his head, and Pemulis is telling Axford to hold his breath. Now, in a stress-heightened voice, Otis P. Lord says he needs Pemulis to real quick come zip inside through the cyclone fence gate south of Court 12, and walk across the theater's four-court map to show Lord how to access the NSTAT calculation that every 1,000 Röntgens of straight X and gamma produces 6.36 deaths per 100 POP, and for the other 93.64 means reduced lifespans of total R minus 100 times the quantity of 0.0636 times total R minus 100 squared years, meaning nobody's exactly going to have to be pricing dentures in Minsk, so to speak, in the future. And so on. After about half the planet's extant megatonnage has been expended, things are looking pretty good for the Amnat crew, even though they and the Sovwar are spacexing back and forth with chilling accuracy. Sovwar's designated launcher is the butch and suspiciously muscular Anne Kittenplan, who at 12 and a half looks like a Belarusian shot putter and has to buy urine more than quarter annually and has a way more lush and impressive mustache than, for instance, Hal himself could raise, and who gets these terrible rages. But so Kitten Plans landed nothing worse than an indirect hit all afternoon, while Amnat's launchman is Todd Postlethwaite, an endomorphic 13-year-old from Edina, Minnesota, whose whole infuriating tennis game consists of nothing but kick serves and topspin lobs, and who's been the Eschaton MVL, most valuable lobber, for the last 2 years, and accuracy-wise has to be seen to be believed.
128.
Still, both sides have artfully avoided the escalation to sack pop that often takes both super combatants right out of the game. And Amnat's president, Lamont Chu, has used the excuse of Gopnik's emotional strikes against the U.S. South, plus Penn's irrational lobbing at an Israel that at the summit was explicitly placed under Amnat's mutual defense umbrella, has used these as golden tactical geese, racking up serious in-deer points against a South AF and Indpac, whose hasty defensive alliance and shaky aim produced nothing more than a lot of irradiated cod off Gloucester. Whenever there's a direct hit, Trolch sits up straight and gets to use the exclamation he's hit on for a kind of announced serial trademark. Holy crow! But Sovwar, beset from two vectors by Amnat and Earlib Seer, whose occasional lob Israel's way, Amnat, drawing a storm of diplomatic protest from South AF and Indpac, keeps instructing Lore to log as regrettable mistargetings. Even with cutting-edge civil defense and EMP-resistant communications, poor old Sovwar is absorbing such serious collateral suffdeer that it's being inexorably impelled by game-theoretic logic to a position where it's going to pretty much have no choice but to go sackpop against Amnat. Now Sovwar Premier Timmy Sleepy TP Peterson petitions OP Lord for capacity/authorization to place a scrambled call to Air Force One. Scrambled call means they don't yell at each other publicly across the court's map. Lord has to ferry messages from one side to the other, complete with inclined heads and hushed tones, etc. Premier and President exchange standard formalities. Premier apologizes for the Prince Albert crack. Hal, who's declining all public chemicals, he's decided, has a gander at Pemulus's rough tallies of combatants, in-deer and suff-deer ratios so far, and agrees to bet Axford a U.S. Finsky. No way Amnat accepts Sovwar's invitation to possible terms. During actionless diplomatic intervals like this, Trolch is reduced to saying, "What a beautiful day for an eschaton!" over and over, then asking people for their thoughts on the game until Pemulus tells him he's cruising to get dope-slapped. There's pretty much nobody around. Tavis and Shtit are off giving what are essentially recruiting talks at indoor clubs in the west suburbs. Pemulus had let tall Paul Shaw take the multi-emblazoned tow truck to take Mario down to the public gardens to watch the public Eye Day festivities with the Bolex H-64. The local kids often go home for the day. A lot of the rest like to lie in the viewing rooms, barely moving all Interdependence Day until the dinner gala. Lord terrasses back and forth between Court 6 and 8, food cart clattering, the food cart which Pemulus and Axford picked up from a kind of a seedy-looking orderly at SJOG Hospital that Pemulus knew from Alston, has one of those crazy left front wheels that, for example, seems always to afflict only your particular grocery cart in supermarkets, and makes a hell of a clattering racket when rushed. Ferrying messages, which the 18 and under guys can tell Amnat and Sovwar are making deliberately oblique and obtuse, so Lord has to do that much more running. God is never a particularly popular role to have to play, and Lord, this fall, has already been the victim of several boarding school-type pranks, too puerile even to detail. J.A.L. Struck Jr., who as usual has made a swine of himself with the suspiciously bracing cups of Gatorade, is abruptly ill all over his own lap, and then sort of slumps to one side in his patio chair with his face slack and white, and doesn't hear Pemulus's quick analysis that Hal might as well give Axhandle the money right now, because Lamont Chu can parse a decision tree with the best of them, and the decision tree's now indicating peace terms in whatever a decision tree's version of neon letters is, because the biggest priority for Amnat right at 15:15 hours is to avoid having to sack pop with Sovwar. Since if the game stops right now, Amnat's probably won, whereas if they sack pop with Sovwar, trading massive infliction of Indir for massive body shots of Sufdir, staying more or less even with each other, Amnat'll still be the same number of points ahead of Sovwar overall, but it'll have taken such heavy Sufdir debits that Irlib Seer, never forget Irlib Seer, brilliantly, if obnoxiously, imammed today by 11-year-old eyebrowless Evan Ingersoll of Binghamton, New York, by staying out of the sackpop fest and lobbing sporadically at Sovwar, just often enough to rack up serious Indir, but not quite enough to piss Sovwar off enough to provoke the retaliatory SS-10 wave that would mean significant Sufdir, could well have a serious shot at overtaking Amnat for the overall eschaton. Especially when you factored in the F of X advantages for bellicosity and non-existent civil defense. At some point, Axford has passed the remainder of the cigarette back over toward Strzok, without looking to see that Strzok is no longer in his chair. And Hal finds himself taking the proffered Dubois and smoking dope in public without even thinking about it or having consciously decided to go ahead. Sure enough, poor red-faced, runny-nosed lord is making way too many clattering trips between Court 6 and 8 for to mean anything but peace terms. Evan Ingersoll is positively strip-mining his right nostril. Finally, Lord stops with the running back and forth and positions himself in the ad service box of Court 7 and loads a new diskette into the You Shit You. Strzok moans something in a possibly foreign tongue. All the other upper-class spectators have scooted their chairs well away from Strzok. Trolch extends a blood-blistered palm and rubs the tips of the hand's fingers together at Hal, and Hal forks over the fin without handing the thin cigarette back over to Axford somehow. Pemulus has leaned forward intently with his pointy chin in his hands. He seems completely absorbed. Interdependence Day, YDAU's eschaton enters probably its most crucial phase. Lord, at his cart and portable teepee, puts on the white beanie. Take notice, not the black or the red beanie, that signals a temporary cessation, a spasex, between two combatants, but allows all other combatants to go on pursuing their strategic interests as they see fit. Sovwar and Amnat are thus pretty vulnerable right now. Sovwar's Premier Peterson and Air Marshal Kittenplan, carrying their white janitorial stockpile bucket between them, walk across Europe and the Atlantic to parley with Amnat President Chu and Supreme Commander Postlethwaite in what looks to be roughly Sierra Leone. Various territories smolder quietly. The other players are mostly standing around beating their arms against their chests to stay warm. A few hesitant white flakes appear and swirl around and melt into dark stars the moment they hit court. A couple ostensible world leaders run here and there in a rather unstatesmanlike fashion, with their mouths open directed at the sky, trying to catch bits of the fall's first snow. Yesterday it had been warmer and rained. Axford speculates about whether snow will mean Shtit might consent to inflate the lung even before the fundraiser 2 weeks hence. Strzok is threatening to fall out of his chair. Pemulus, leaning forward intently, wearing his Mr. Howell yachting cap, ignores everyone. He hates to type and keeps his tallies via pencil and clipboard, a la DeLint. The idling Ford sedan is conspicuous for the excruciated full-color, old, Nunhagen aspirin ad on the green of its right rear door. Hal and Axford are passing what looks to the combatants like a suckerless Tootsie Roll stick back and forth between them, and occasionally to Trolch. Trevor, the axe-handle Axford, has a total of only 3.5 digits on his right hand. From West House you can hear Mrs. Clark and the time-and-a-half holiday kitchen staff preparing the Interdependence Day gala dinner, which always includes dessert. Now, Red Chai itself quietly trying to rack up some unanswered endear, sends a towering topspin lob into Inpak's quadrant, scoring what Red Chai claims is a direct hit on Karachi, and what warheadless Inpak claims is only an indirect hit on Karachi. It's an uneasy moment. A dispute such as this would never occur in the real God's real world, since the truth would be manifest in the actual size of the actual weenie roast in the actual Karachi. But God here is played by Otis B. Lord, and Lord is number-crunching so fiendishly at the carts you shit you, trying to confirm the verisimilitude of the peace terms Amnat and Sovwar are hashing out, that he can't even pretend to have seen where Red Chai's strike against Impact landed with respect to Karachi's T-shirt, which is admittedly kind of mashed and wopsed up, though this could be primarily from breezes and feet. And in his lapse of omniscience cannot see how he's supposed to allocate the relevant Indir and Sufdir points. Trulch doesn't know whether to say, "Holy crow!" or not. Lord, vexed by a lapse it's tough to see how any mortal could have avoided, appeals over to Michael Pemulis for an independent ruling. And when Pemulis gravely shakes his white-headed head, pointing out that Lord is God and either sees or doesn't in Eschaton, Lord has an intense little crying fit that's made abruptly worse when now J.J. Penn of Indpak all of a sudden gets the idea to start claiming that now that it's snowing, the snow totally affects blast area and fire area and pulse intensity and maybe also has fallout implications. And he says Lord has to now completely redo everybody's damage parameters before anybody can form realistic strategies from here on out. Pemulis's chair legs shriek and make red-skinned peanuts spill out in a kind of cornucopic cone shape. And he's up in his capacity as sort of Eminence Grise of Eschaton, and ranging up and down just outside the theater's chain-link fencing, giving J.J. Penn the very roughest imaginable side of his tongue. Besides being real sensitive to any theater boundary puncturing threats to the map's integrity, threats that have come up before, and that, as Pemulis sees it, threaten the game's whole sense of animating realism, which realism depends on buying the artifice of 1,300 meters squared of composition tennis court representing the whole rectangular projection of the planet Earth. Pemulis is also a sworn foe of all Penns for all time. It had been J.J. Penn's much older brother, Miles Penn, now 21, and flailing away on the grim Third World Satellite Pro Tour, playing for travel expenses in bleak, dysenteric locales, who, when Pemulis first arrived at ETA at age 11, had christened him Michael Penisless, and had had Pemulis convinced for almost a year that if he pressed on his belly button, his ass would fall off.
129.
It's snowing on the goddamn map, not the territory, you dick! Pemulis yells at Penn. His lower lip is out and quivering. Pemulis's face is the face of a man who will someday need blood pressure medication. A constitution, the tenuate doesn't help one bit. Trulch is sitting up straight and speaking very intensely and quietly into his headset. Hal, who in his day never wore the beanie, and usually portrayed some marginal nation somewhere out in the nuclear boondocks, finds himself more intrigued by Penn's map-slash-territory faux pas than upset by it, or even amused. Pemulis turns back to the pavilion and seems to be looking at Hal in some kind of appeal.
Jesus!
Except is the territory the real world, quote-unquote, though? Axford calls across to Pemulis, whose pacing like the fence is between him and some sort of prey. Axford knows quite well Pemulis can be fucked with when he's like this. When he's hot, he always cools down and becomes contrite. Struck tries to yell at Iker twang on Pemulis but can't get the megaphone he makes of his hands to fit over his mouth.
The real world's what the map here stands for!
Lord lifts his head from the you shit you and cries over at Axe Handle, trying to please Pemulis.
Kinda looks like real world type snow from here, MP!
Axford calls out, his forehead still maroon from the coughing fit. Trulch is trying to describe the distinction between the symbolic map of the gear-littered courts and the global strategic theater it stands for, using all and only sports broadcast cliches. Hal looks from Axandel to Pemulus to Lord. Strzok finally falls out of his chair, with a clunk, but his legs are still somehow entangled in the legs of the chair. It starts to snow harder, and dark stars of melt begin to multiply and then merge all over the courts. Otis Lord is trying to type and wipe his nose on his sleeve at the same time. Jay Gopnik and Kay McKenna are running around well outside their assigned quadrants with their tongues outstretched.
Real-world snow isn't a factor if it's falling on the fucking map!
And Kittenplan's crew-cutted head now protrudes from the kind of rugby scrum Amnats and Sovwar's heads of state form around Lord's computational food cart.
For Christ's sake, leave us alone!
She shrieks at Pemulus. Trolch is going, oh my, into his headset. Oh, Lord, is struggling with the cart's protective umbrella, his head's beanies, little white propeller rotating in a rising wind. A light dusting of snow is starting to appear in the player's hair.
It's only real-world snow if it's already in the scenario!
Pemulus keeps directing everything at Penn, who hasn't said a word since his original suggestion, and is busy sort of casually kicking the Karachi shirt over into the Arabian Sea, clearly hoping the original detonation will get forgotten about in all the meta-theoretical fuss. Pemulus rages along the East Court's western fence. The combination of several tenuate spanules plus eschaton adrenaline bring his blue-collar Irish right out. He's a muscular but fundamentally physically narrow guy. Head, hands, the sharp little wad of cartilage at the tip of Pemulus's nose. Everything about him seems to Hal to taper and come to a point, like a bad El Greco. Hal leans to spit and watches him pace like a caged thing as Lord works feverishly over Enstat's peace terms decision matrix. Hal wonders, not for the first time, whether he might deep down be a secret snob about collar, color issues, and Pemulus. Then whether the fact that he's capable of wondering whether he's a snob attenuates the possibility that he's really a snob. Though Hal hasn't had more than 4 or 5 total, very small hits off the public Dubois, this is a prime example of what's sometimes called marijuana thinking. You can tell because Hal's leaned way over to spit, but has gotten lost in a paralytic thought helix and hasn't yet spit, even though he's right in bombing position over the NASA glass. It also occurs to him that he finds the real snow slash unreal snow snag in the eschaton extremely abstract, but somehow way more interesting than the eschaton itself so far. Earlib Sears strongman Evan Ingersoll, all of 1.3 meters tall, warmed by baby fat and high-calorie cerebral endeavor, has been squatting on his heels like a catcher just west of Damascus, spinning his Rosignol launcher idly in his hand, watching the one-sided exchange between Pemulus and Ingersoll's roommate, J.J. Penn, who's now threatening to quit and go in for Coco, if they can't, for once, play eschaton without the big guys horning in again like always. There's a tiny whirring sound as Ingersoll's mental gears grind. For the duration of the little Sierra Leone summit and the studious blankness on everybody's face, it's pretty clear that Sovwar and Amnat are going to come to terms. And the terms are likely to involve Sovwar agreeing not to go sackpop against Amnat, in return for Amnat letting Sovwar go sackpop against Ingersoll's Earlib Seer, because if Sovwar goes sackpop against an Earlib Seer that can't have many warheads left in the old bucket by now, Ingersoll knows they know, then Sovwar'll get to rack up a lot of in-deer without much suff-deer, while inflicting such suff-deer on Earlib Seer that Earlib Seer will effectively be eliminated as a threat to Amnat's commanding lead in points, which is what has the most utility in the old game theoretic matrix right now. The exact utility transformations are too oogly for an Ingersoll who's still grappling with fractions, but he can see clearly that this would be the most remorselessly logical, best interest conducive scenario for both Lamont Chu and especially the sleepster, Peterson, who's hated Ingersoll for months now anyway without any good reason or cause or anything. Ingersoll can just somehow tell. Hal, paralyzed and absorbed, watches Ingersoll bob on his haunches and shift his stick from hand to hand, and cerebrate furiously and logically conclude, then, that Irlib Seer's highest possible strategic utility lies in Amnat and Sovwar failing to come to terms. Hal can almost visualize a dark light bulb going on above Ingersoll's head. Pemulus is telling Penn that there's a critical distinction between horning in and letting asswipes like Jeffrey Joseph Penn run roughshod over the delimiting boundaries that are Eschaton's very lifeblood. Chew and Peterson are nodding soberly at little things they're saying to each other, while Kittenplan cracks her knuckles and Postlethwaite bounces a warhead idly on his strings. So now Evan Ingersoll rises from his squat now, only to bend again and take a warhead out of Irlib Seer's ordnance bucket. And Hal seems to be the only one who sees Ingersoll line up the vector very carefully with his slim thumb and take a lavish backswing and fire the ball directly at the little circle of super-combatant leaders in West Africa. It's not a lob. It flies straight as if shot from a rifle and strikes Ann Kittenplan right in the back of the head with a loud thock. She whirls to face east, a hand at the back of her bristly skull, scanning and then locking on Damascus, her face a stony, Toltec death mask. Pemulus and Penn and Lord and everyone else all freeze, shocked and silent. So there's just the weird, glittered hiss of falling snow and the sounds of a couple crows interfacing in the pines over by the headmaster's house. The ATH-SCME fans are silent, and four sweat-sock-shaped clouds of exhaust hang motionless over the Sunstrand stacks. Nothing moves. No Eschaton combatant has ever intentionally struck another combatant's physical person with a 5-megaton thermonuclear weapon. No matter how frayed players' nerves, it's never made a lick of sense. A combatant's megatonnage is too precious to waste on personal attacks outside the map. It's been like this unspoken, but very basic rule. Ann Kittenplan is so shocked and enraged that she stands there transfixed, quivering, her sights locked on Ingersoll and his smoking Rosinol. Otis P. Lord feels at his beanie. Ingersoll now makes a show of examining the tiny nails of his left hand and casually suggests that Irlib Seer has just scored a direct 5-megaton contact burst against Sovwar's entire launch capacity, namely Air Marshal Ann Kittenplan, and that plus also Amnat's own launch capacity, plus both combatants' ordnance and heads of state, all lie well within the blast's kill radius, which by Ingersoll's rough calculations extends from the Ivory Coast to the Devil's Alley's Senegal. Unless, of course, that kill radius is somehow altered by the possible presence of climatic snow, he adds, beaming. Pemulus and Kittenplan now each let loose with a linear series of anti-Ingersoll invectives that drown each other out and make the trees, crows, take slow flight. But Otis Lord, who's watched the exchange, ashen, and has called up something relevant on NSTAT's Treemaster meta-decision subdirectory, now, to everyone's horror, removes from around his neck a shoelace with a little nickel-colored key and bends to the small locked Solander box on the food cart's bottom shelf, and as everyone watches in horror, opens the box and with near ceremonial care exchanges the white beanie on his head for the red beanie that signifies utter global crisis. The dreaded red UGC beanie has been donned by an Eschaton game master only once before, and that was over 3 years ago, when human input error on NSTAT's tallies of aggregate suff deer during a 3-way sack pop free-for-all yielded an apparent ignition of the Earth's atmosphere. Now a real-world chill descends over the grainily white-swirled landscape of the nuclear theater. Pemulus tells Lord he cannot believe his fucking eyes. He tells Lord how dare he don the dreaded red beanie over such an obvious instance of map-not-territory, equivocationary horseshit as Ingersoll's trying to foist. Lord, vent to the cart's blinking, you shit you, responds that there seems to be a problem. Ingersoll is whistling and pretending to do the Charleston between Abu Kamal and Es-Suida, using his racket like a hoofer's cane. Hal finally spits. Under Pemulus's wild-eyed stare, Lord clears his throat and calls out to Ingersoll, tentatively positing that today's pre-game triggering situation negotiations established no valid strategic target areas in the postage-stamp-sized nation of Sierra Leone. Ingersoll calls back across the Mediterranean that target areas of keen strategic interest appeared in Sierra Leone at the exact moment the heads of state and total launch capacities of AMNAT and SOVWAR took it upon themselves to traipse into Sierra Leone. That Sierra Leone thenceforward, as of that moment, has, or rather, had, he pretends to correct with a smile, become a de facto S-STRAC. If presidents and premiers wanted to leave the protection of their territory's defense nets and hold clicky little other combatant excluding parlays in some hut somewhere, that was up to them. But Lord had been wearing the white beanie that explicitly authorized the over-exploited and underdeveloped defenders of the one true faith of the world to keep on pursuing their strategic interests, and Earlib Seer was now keenly interested in the aggregate endear points it had coming to them for just now vaporizing both supercombatants' strategic capacities with one flaming sword of the most high-like strike.
And Kittenplan keeps taking a couple quivery steps toward Ingersoll and getting restrained and pulled back by Lamont Chu.
Sleepy T.P. Peterson, who always looks a little dazed even in the best of circumstances, asks Otis P. Lore to define equivocationary for him, causing Hal Incandenza to laugh out loud despite himself. Just outside the theater's fence, Pemulus is bug-eyed with fury, not impossibly dreen-aggravated,
and is literally jumping up and down in one spot so hard that his yachting cap jumps slightly off his head with each impact,
which Trolch and Axford confer and agree they have previously seen occur only in animated cartoons. Pemulus howls that Lord is, in his vacillation, appeasing Ingersoll in Ingersoll's effort to fatally fuck the very breath and bread of Eschaton.
130.
Players themselves can't be valid targets. Players aren't inside the goddamn game. Players are part of the apparatus of the game. They're part of the map. It's snowing on the players, but not on the territory. They're part of the map, not the cluster fucking territory. You can only launch against the territory, not against the map. It's like the one ground rule boundary that keeps Eschaton from degenerating into chaos. Eschaton, gentlemen, is about logic and axiom and mathematical probity and discipline and verity and order. You do not get points for hitting anybody real. Only the gear that maps what's real. Pemulus keeps looking back over his shoulder to the pavilion and screaming, Jesus! Ingersoll's roommate, J.J. Penn, tries to claim that the vaporized Ann Kittenplan is wearing several articles of gear worth mucho endear, and everyone tells him to shut up. The snow is now coming down hard enough to compose an environment, and everybody outside the sheltered pavilion looks gauzily shrouded from Hal's perspective. Lord is crunching madly away at the teepee under the just-opened protection of an old beach umbrella a previous game master had welded to the top of the food cart. Lord wipes his nose against the same shoulder that's clamping a phone to his ear, awkwardly, and reports he's checked with the DEC's Eschaton Axiom Directory via Pink 2 capable modem, and that, unfortunately, with all due respect to Anne and Mike, it doesn't seem to explicitly say players with strategic functions can't become target areas if they traipse around outside their defense nets. Lamont Chu says how come point values for actual players have never been assigned then, for Pete's sake? And Pemulus shouts across that that's so totally beside the point it doesn't matter.
That the reason players aren't explicitly exempted in the ESCAX dot directory is that their exemption is what makes Eschaton and its axioms fucking possible in the first place.
A kind of pale boat wake of exhaust exits the idling Ford sedan off behind the pavilion and widens as it rises, dispersing. Pamela says, because otherwise, use your heads, otherwise non-strategic emotions would get aroused and combatants would be whacking balls at each other's physical persons all the time. An eschaton wouldn't even be possible in its icily elegant game theoretical form. They stop jumping up and down at least, Trulch observes. Player's exemption from strikes goes without saying, Pamela says. It's like pre-axiomatic. Pamela tells Lore to consider what he's doing very carefully. Because from where Pemulus is standing, Lord looks to be willing to very possibly compromise Eschaton's map for all time. Girls 16s and 18s Prorector, Mary Esther Thode, puts from left to right behind the pavilion on the long driveway from the circular drive to the portcullis, and halts her scooter and lifts her helmet's tinted visor and yells across for Kitten Plan to put a hat on if she's going to play in the snow in a crew cut. This, even though Kitten Plan isn't even strictly in Ms. Thode's, like, umbrella of authority, Axford observes to Trulch, who relays this fact into his headset. Hal moves his mouth around to try to gather up spit in a mouth that's gotten rather dry, which, when you have a plug of Kodiak in, is not very pleasant. And Kitten Plan has been suffering from what looked like almost Parkinsonian tremors for the last few minutes, her face writhing and her mustache almost standing right out straight. Lamont Chu repeats his claim that there's no way players, even with strategic functions, can ever be legit target areas if no indir/sufdir values have been entered for them in NSTAT's tally function. Pamulus orders Chu not to distract Otis Lord from the incredibly potent and lethal ground Lord's letting Ingersoll lead them onto. He says none of them have ever even seen the true meaning of the word crisis yet. Ingersoll calls over to Pamulus that his emeritus veto power is only over Lord's calculations, not over today's game's God's decisions about what's part of the game and what isn't. Pamulus invites Ingersoll to do something anatomically impossible. Pamulus asks Lamont Chu and Ann Kittenplan if they're just going to stand there with their thumbs in their bottoms and let Lord let Ingersoll eliminate Eschaton's map for keeps for one slimy, cheesy victory in just one day's apocalypse. Kittenplan has been trembling and feeling at the back of her vein-laced head and looking across the Mediterranean at Ingersoll like somebody who knows they'll go to prison for what they want to do. Axford posits certain very unlikely physical conditions under which what Pemulus told Ingersoll to do to himself wouldn't be totally impossible. Hal spits thickly and gathers and tries to spit again, watching. Trulch broadcasts the fact that there's always a queer, vague, vitaminish stink about Mary Esther Thode that he never can quite place. There's the sudden tripartite whomp of three Empire waste displacement vehicles being propelled above the cloud cover to points far north. Hal identifies Thode's ambient odor as the stink of thiamine, which, for reasons best known to Thode, she takes a lot of. And Trulch broadcasts the datum and refers to Hal as a close source, which strikes Hal as odd and somehow off in a way he can't quite name. Kittenplan shakes Chu's arm loose and darts over and extracts a warhead from Sovwar's portable stockpile and shouts out that, well, okay then, if players can be targets, then in that case... And she fires a real screamer at Ingersoll's head, which Ingersoll barely blocks with his Rosignol and shrieks that Kittenplan can't launch anything at anything because she's been vaporized by a 5-megaton contact burst. Kittenplan tells Ingersoll to write his congressman about it, and over Lamont Chu's pleas for reasoned discussion, takes several more theoretically valuable warheads out of the industrial solvent bucket and gets truly serious about hitting Ingersoll, moving steadily across Nigeria and Chad, causing Ingersoll to run due north across the quartz map at impressive speed, abandoning Earlib Sears' ammo bucket and tear-assing up through Siberia, crying, "Foul!" Lord mewing ineffectually for order, but some of the other combatants' staffs have begun to smell that Evan Ingersoll's become fair game for cruelty, the way kids can seemed to smell this sort of thing out with such uncanny acuity, and Red Chai's general secretary and an Amnat vector planning specialist and Josh Gopnik all start moving northeast over the map, firing balls as hard as they can at Ingersoll, who's dropped his launcher and is shaking frantically at the chain gate on the fence's north side, where Mrs. Incandenza has decided she doesn't want kids exiting the east courts and trampling her calliopsis. And these little kids can hit balls exceptionally hard. Hal is now unable to gather enough spit to spit. One warhead hits Ingersoll in the neck, and another solidly in the meat of the thigh. Ingersoll begins to limp around in small circles holding his neck, crying in that slow-motion, shuddery way little kids have when they're crying more at the fact of being hurt than at the hurt itself. Famulus is walking backwards away from the south fence, back toward the pavilion, and has both arms up in either appeal or fury or something else. Axford tells Hal and Trolch he wishes he didn't feel the dark thrill he felt watching Ingersoll get pummeled. Some filmy red peanut skin has gotten into Jim Strzok's hair as he lies there, motionless. O.P. Lord attempts to rule that Ingersoll is no longer on the four courts of Eschaton's Earth map, and so isn't even theoretically a valid target area. It doesn't matter. Several kids close in on Ingersoll, triangulating their bombardment. T. Peterson on point. Ingersoll is hit several times, once right near the eye. Jim Trolch is up and running to the fence, wanting to stop the thing, but Famulus catches him by his headset's cord and tells him to let them all lie in their own bed. Hal, now leaning forward, steeple-fingered, finds himself just about paralyzed with absorption. Trevor Axford, fist to his chin, asks Hal if he's ever just simply fucking hated somebody without having any idea why. Hal finds himself riveted at something about the degenerating game that seems so terribly abstract and fraught with implications and consequences that even thinking about how to articulate it seems so complexly stressful that being almost incapacitated with absorption is almost the only way out of the complex stress. Now, Indpak's Penn and Amnat's McKenna, who have long-standing personal bones to pick with Ann Kittenplan, peel off and gather ordnance and execute a pincer movement on Ann Kittenplan. She is hit twice from behind at close range. Ingersoll has long since gone down and is still getting hit. Lord is ruling at the top of his lungs that there's no way Amnat can launch against itself when he gets tagged right on the breastbone by an errant warhead. Clutching his chest with one hand, with the other he flicks the red beanie's propeller, never before flicked, whose flickered spin heralds a worst-case and utterly decontrolled Armageddon-type situation. Tim Peterson takes a ball in the groin and goes down like a sack of refined flour. Everybody's scooping up spent warheads and totally unrealistically refiring them. The fences shudder and sing as balls rain against them. Ingersoll now resembles some sort of animal that's been run over in the road. Trolch, who's looking for the first time at the idling sedan by Westhouse's dumpsters, and asking if anybody knew anybody who drove a Nunhagen aspirin-adverting Ford, is the only upper-class spectator who doesn't seem utterly silently engrossed. Ann Kittenplan has dropped her racket and is charging McKenna. She takes two contact bursts in the breast area before she gets to him and lays McKenna out with an impressive left cross. Lamont Chu tackles Todd Postlethwaite from behind. Strzok looks to have wet his pants in his sleep. J.J. Penn slips on a grounded warhead near Fiji and goes spectacularly down. The snowfall makes everything gauzy and terribly clear at the same time, eliminating all visual background so that the map's action seems stark and surreal. Nobody's using tennis balls now anymore. Josh Gopnik punches Lamont Chu in the stomach, and Lamont Chu yells that he's been punched in the stomach. And Kittenplan has Kieran McKenna in a headlock and is punching him repeatedly on the top of his skull. Otis P. Lord lets down the beach umbrella and starts pushing his crazy wheeled food cart at a diskette rattling clip toward 12's open south gate, still flicking furiously at the red beanie's propeller. Strzok's hair is steadily accreting nutskins. Famulus is undercover, but still standing, his legs well apart, and his arms folded. The figure in the green Ford still hasn't moved once. Trolch says he, for his own part, wouldn't be just sitting and lying there if any of the little buddies under his personal charge were out there getting potentially injured. And Hal reflects that he does feel a certain sort of intense anxiety, but can't sort through the almost infinite-seeming implications of what Trolch is saying fast enough to determine whether the anxiety is over something about what he's seeing, or something in connection between what Trolch is saying and the degree to which he's absorbed in what's going on out inside the fence, which is a degenerative chaos so complex in its disorder that it's hard to tell whether it seems choreographed or simply chaotically disordered. Lamont Chew is throwing up into the Indian Ocean. Todd Postlethwaite has his hands to his face and is shrieking something about his doze. It is now, beyond any argument or equivocation, snowing. The sky is off-white. Lord and his cart are now literally making tracks for the edge of the map. Evan Ingersoll hasn't moved in several minutes. Penn lies in a whitening service box with one leg bent beneath him at an impossible angle. Someone way off behind them has been blowing an athletic whistle. And Kitten Plan begins to chase Red Chai's general secretary south across the Asian subcontinent at top speed. Pemulus is telling Hal he hates to say he told them so. Hal can see Axford leaning way forward, sheltering something tiny from the wind as he flicks at it with a spent lighter. It occurs to him this is the third anniversary of Axhandle losing a right finger and half his right thumb. Fierce little Jay Gopnik is flailing at the air and telling whoever wants it to come on, come on. Otis P. Lord and his cart sail, clattering across Indochina toward the southern gate. Hal is suddenly aware that Trolch and Pemulus are wincing, but is not himself wincing, and isn't sure why they are wincing, and is looking out into the fray trying to determine whether he should be wincing, when Red Shy's general secretary, calling loudly for his mother, and in full flight, as he looks over his shoulder at Anne Kittenplan's contorted face, barrels directly into Lord's speeding food cart. There's a noise like the historical sum of all cafeteria accidents everywhere. 3.6-megabyte diskettes take flight like mad bats across what uncovered would be the baseline of Court 12. Different colored beanies spill from the rolling cylinder box, whose lock's hasp is broken and protrudes like a tongue as it rolls. The teepee's monitor and modem and you-shit-you chassis, with most of Eschaton's nervous system on its hard drive, assume a parabolic southwest vector. The heavy equipment's altitude is impressive. An odd, silent, still moment hangs, the teepee aloft. Pemulus bellows, his hands to his cheeks. Otis P. Lord hurdles the bent forms of food cart and general secretary and sprints low over the court's map's snow, trying to save hardware that's now at the top of its rainbow's arc. It's clear Lord won't make it. It's a slow-motion moment. The snow falls more than heavy enough now, Hal thinks, to excuse Lord's not seeing Lamont Chew directly before him, on his hands and knees, throwing up. Lord impacts Chew's arched form at about knee level, and is spectacularly airborne. The idling Ford reveals a sudden face at the driver's side window. Axford is holding the lighter's chassis up to his ear and shaking it. And Kittenplan is ramming Red Chai's leader's face repeatedly into the mesh of the south fence. Lord's flight's parabola is less spectacular on the Y-axis than the TP's has been. The you-shit-use hard drive chassis makes an indescribable sound as it hits the earth, and its brightly circuited guts come out. The color monitor lands on its back with its screen blinking error at the white sky. Hal and everyone else can project Lord's flight's own terminus an instant before impact. For a brief moment that Hal will later regard as completely and uncomfortably bizarre, Hal feels at his own face to see whether he is wincing. The distant whistle patweets. Lord does indeed go, head first down, through the monitor screen, and stays there.